Hello and welcome to Inside Exercise. I'm Emeritus Professor Glenn McConnell from Victoria University in Australia. Today I'm bringing to you a very interesting chat I've just had with Professor Pope Mosley from Arizona State University. He has a very interesting and sort of different background. He started off as a lung and intensive care specialist physician, and then he literally ran into Carl Gazzolfi. So they were both at Iowa. So Pope was looking at heat shock proteins. Carl Gazzolfi was a huge name in exercise in the gut. And they ended up working together and did the first studies showing that exercise increases heat shock proteins in humans. And Pope was showing that the actual gut barrier, that, you know, preventing sort of things you don't want in the gut getting into the blood, can break down during exercise when you have a reduction in blood flow to the gut, increase in temperature. And also he talked about how exercise training can increase heat shock proteins and be protective in this way. Pope's also done very important work showing that heat shock proteins and autophagy, which is, you know, the breaking down, turning over proteins in your cells, interact. So very interesting studies with that. And very important work showing through bioinformatics that a lot of the heat-related deaths are actually not from the temperature per se, but from the effects that other illnesses and trauma that the person has had earlier in life and then make them more susceptible to the heat later in life. So he's finding that only about 20% of the deaths are actually directly related to the heat. And finally, and interestingly, we had a great chat about his interest in kettlebells and how he incorporates that into his lifestyle. So he had a traumatic back injury, which required surgery. He then got on to kettlebells, and it's been very successful. And now in his 60s, he's actually become an instructor in kettlebells and is doing great physically. So very interesting chat. So stay around. Hi, Pope. How are you? Welcome to Inside Exercise. Thanks for coming on.
Well, hi, Glenn. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, great. So the avid followers of this podcast, which I hope there's many, will know that this is the second time we've had someone on talking about heat shock protein. So I had Paige Geiger on probably 6 months ago, talking about heat shock, exercise, and how heat can affect diabetes, et cetera. So a bit of a different spin on things today. Well, not spin, but a different discussion around heat, exercise effects on the gut, how heat shock proteins can affect autophagy, protein turnover, things like all sorts of things like that. But first of all, I'm really interested in how you ended up where you are. So a large reason why I asked you on was the interesting mix. So, you know, started off sort of a critical care type doctor, and then exercise. Oh, I don't know the order there, what came first. And then ended up being, an instructor in your 60s in kettlebell, which is interesting as well. So tell us a little bit about how you ended up being where you're at now.
Sure. Well, I'm in the very late phase of a career. So I'm actually working part-time at Arizona State University. The dean of the College of Health Solutions asked me to come over and build a program on heat and health, which is obviously very important in a place like Arizona. So I had, that's my current deal. I started out, I was always going to be a biomedical researcher. I mean, I got my MD with the thought of doing research. And my residency, which is a 3-year program in the States, I was given 18 months or half of it to be in a wet lab to build my program. I mean, I built enough of a program that I was able to get an NIH grant as a fellow. So I had a lot of early good support to build my career.
Okay, so you started off, were you a sports person who got interested in exercise? Did you become a medical doctor and then get interested in exercise? How did things sort of work out?
Yeah, well, I was working on lung injury, and I guess this is kind of an odd story. So I was a runner though. I was I ran cross country in college, and I was training up for a 5K, and a good friend of mine, a guy named Carl Gazzolfi, was down the way. He was an exercise scientist. I was working on heat shock proteins and cellular adaptations to injury. So the track was about a mile and a quarter away, and we jog to the track, do our interval workout, Carl and I were really into intervals at those in those days. And then we'd jog back. So during the time of jogging to the track, we'd talk about what we did. And I knew Carl, but I didn't know a whole lot about what he did. And he started talking about what he was doing. He was talking about exercising people and looking at heat adaptation. And I remember exactly the point on the jog where I turned to him and I said, you know, Carl, we're sort of doing the same thing. I'm just doing it in cells and you're doing it in people. Mm-hmm. You think we could design an experiment? And so I designed an experiment to look at whether we could see heat shock proteins in people. At that time, no one had actually done that. And so I designed a study, and Carl and a great grad student, Al Ryan, we did the study, and we were able to see a heat shock response in humans. This is long before people had worked out what was really happening, but it was cool. It was a demonstration that you could alter the heat shock response through exercise in the heat.
So you're saying that's the first time people had looked at heat shock proteins in people full stop or with exercise or?
Oh, people had looked at, and tried to look at heat shock proteins, and there was always this issue of, people have fevers and they don't have a heat shock response. This is before anyone knew about the ideas of NF-kappa B. I mean, we demonstrated a heat shock response. There were no antibodies for heat shock proteins then. We did it. We used an S35 technique that I built to actually look at heat shock in exercising humans. And that was that paper in Journal of Applied Physiology back in the 90s. And in fact, we actually got some of the first antibodies from a scientist at UC San Francisco who had made the first antibodies. So we were on the list to get antibodies and do our studies. So we started out really early.
Because I mean, I know Carl Gazzolfi is just a legend with exercise and the gut. Mm-hmm. And a good mate back when I did my master's with David Costa at Ball State, and a good mate, Pat Lambert, went and did his postdoc with him. So that's a big name. He died a long time ago. But what tissues are we actually looking at with the heat shock proteins?
This is the first time anybody had shown this. So what we did is we needed a tissue that we could access and put in an incubator. So the way we did this study is that there is a sort of an early understanding that if you give a cell a 50 unit, some sort of stress that generates 50 units of heat shock protein, mm-hmm. and then you come back while the cell has 50 units of heat shock protein and you give it 100 unit stress, mm-hmm. then it'll only generate 50 more because it already has 50, right? Mm-hmm. It's a cumulative thing as the heat shock, before the heat shock protein degrades. So I figured we could actually look at this by exercising people, which would be the first stress, then taking cells out, giving them a controlled heat stress in an incubator under S35. So, and then the proteins would incorporate radioactive methionine, and then we'd do a radio blot and see it. And so what you saw was that in people who were naive to stress, there was, and then we put their white cells in the incubator, you saw this big heat shock response that you're supposed to see. But the people who had exercised had a far lower heat shock measurable thing. So it was like a photographic negative.
So because they'd already had the activation.
Yes. And that's how we did it. And that's cool. Okay. It was a pretty neat, I thought it was, I was proud of myself. It was a cool idea. Yeah. And, but so we used polymorphonucleocytes. We used cells that we could easily put, mm-hmm. That we could easily incubate, pull out of someone and put in an incubator. And that's kind of how we did it.
Actually, so this is in Iowa. Now, I'm just worried I'll forget about this, something we chatted about at the start. Talking about legends that you've worked with. So you also mentioned how you've been to Australia and worked with John Sutton and or had some association with John Sutton, who's a huge name, who died again a long time ago. But then you mentioned Bengt Soltén in Copenhagen, and he died just a couple of years, 2019. Why don't you tell us a little bit about those links as well?
Sure. Well, John invited me out to give a lecture in, I think it was back in 95, and there were a group of Australian scientists there, and I was one of the lecturers, and it was neat because people really hadn't thought about heat shock protein so much back then. It was still kind of a cellular phenomenon, and I was talking about something a little different. And I'll tell you, the best thing about that conference is at the end of the conference, there were five invited speakers, and John gave each of them a University of Sydney College tie, mm-hmm. the four of them. And for me, he took off his Sydney Olympic tie and gave it to me. So I have that tie and I wear it proudly from John. One of my proudest moments was having at an exercise conference, having John talking about heat stroke and the study, the really interesting things, early, incredibly interesting studies that John did, really a pioneer in the field. And he said, I still remember he said in the conference, the only way that heat stroke makes sense is if you look at the model that Mosley and Gisolfi proposed of gut leak. And I think that's what's happening. And I was so proud of that because we were, you know, I was working, I had not worked in exercise, and I was starting to see really interesting parallels to my work on cellular injury. And so my first NIHR01s were all on exercise adaptation. So I had earlier studies of lung injury, but my first big grants turned out to be in exercise.
That's very interesting. I wonder if I can give a little personal note there. So John Sutton was a massive name in heat and exercise. And funnily enough, I'd actually done, there's a big race. I think it's the biggest, we call it a fun run in the world. It's 80,000 people. It's a 14-kilometer race in Sydney from downtown Sydney to the beach. Yeah. Do you know that?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. The Sea to Surf.
There you go.
Sea to Surf, yeah.
Yeah, so I'd done that a lot, and that was my big thing. And anyway, one race I did it, and it was the best time I ever did. And I was like, just finished. And I thought I was fine. I was just leaning against a pole. And someone came up and grabbed me, said, "You're coming with me." So apparently I was just wobbling everywhere, but I felt totally normal. And they strapped me down and I was getting aggressive. I was wanting to go, like, I got to meet my wife, my girlfriend, my mum. And I didn't believe the time on my watch. I said, it says it's only 10 minutes since I finished. I finished like hours ago. What time is it? And I was worried they'd left already. I was just totally delirious. So they had to strap me down because I wanted to get up. So they infused me and put cold pads. But the point is, years later, John Sutton's giving a talk and he's talking about the city to surf and how many heat strokes there were and how many. And it was like, that was the year I did it. Yeah. So that was amazing. I was like, one of the end of that. So, and that I've never forgotten that because that was weird. By the time they let me go, so they felt I was good enough to let go, but I'm sure they had hundreds coming through. I still didn't believe my watch and I thought it was too late. So I walked home like 10 kilometers, so six miles. And my girlfriend and my mum are still waiting to meet me. So I was just totally, so anyway, that's my little insight into what it can do. But I wonder, maybe we'll bring up Copenhagen later and Bengt Soltén, but I wonder if we could talk, we've got a famous example here. I don't know if you know about it, a guy called Chris Lee. I think he got like third in Y Ironman or one Ironman. He was just all over the place, wobbling everywhere. And he ended up losing part of his gut, I think 6 inches or something of his gut. So I wonder if you can talk to us a bit about the leaky gut and the stuff you've done on that and what's going on.
Sure. Let me step back to John a minute. For the scientists that are listening, I'd pull out some of John's old papers and look at them. They're brilliant. It's 30 years and they're brilliant. Look at them.
Exactly right.
So the gut. So Carl and I used to talk. Carl was working on absorption of fluids, sports drinks and things, and how you could see absorption of things. And I wanted to look the other way. because I just figured that it's the gut. Carl had shown very early on that once you get a mild elevation in temperature, blood flow to the gut drops dramatically. You know, you've got 20 liters of pipes and 5 liters of blood, and you make choices. And so when you're trying to cool your body, you pull blood away from the gut. And the gut villus is already really ischemic. So even under normal perfusion, the PO2 at a villus tip is about 40. So it's already tenuous. So knowing that, I thought, well, boy, if you just, if you applied that heat and you looked at what happened to the epithelial barrier, if you looked at an epithelial barrier and we had done this in lung disease and other things, if you just built an in vitro model of a barrier, and there were many people doing this kind of work in lung stuff, and we decided we'd do a gut model, grow epithelial cells, and then simply expose them to heat and look at the change in transepithelial resistance, which is a measure of iron.
I want to just explain to people that aren't sort of gut people, and even I wonder sometimes, that just the epithelial, just do you want to just explain like the sort of the layers and, you know, very basically just to say what we're talking about here? Because I know you're going to talk about tight junctions and things. Just a bit of a anatomy lesson quickly here.
Well, I won't go into too much. The epithelium is, an epithelial barrier. It's a very fast growing epithelium. It changes over every 3 or 4 days. So the cells grow along the villus, the little fingers that are our absorptive space, and then are sloughed off into the gut. But in order to keep outside out and inside in, there are a whole series of tight junctions, and material, whether it's nutrients or fluid or whatever, you either move through the cell or they move around the cell. And so as long as the gates are working and controlled, you have a normal situation. But what we were talking about, so when you look at what happens in heat stroke, when you take a patient with heat stroke, what you see is multi-organ failure. You see astronomically high liver enzymes from an injured liver. You see blood coagulation problems. They look very much like somebody just injected endotoxin into them. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I was thinking. This is what's going on, is that the gut is the critical target tissue. You place it under stress by pulling the blood flow away and raising the temperature. And at what point does the epithelium leak? So when we subjected gut cells to mild elevations in temperature, they leak like crazy. And what was neat, of course, was that if we, first of all, we gave them a heat stress to generate a heat shock response, and we repeat those studies, and the epithelium was much tighter, didn't leak as easily. And then we made some cells where we overexpressed heat shock proteins in the cell. So the cell was just making bucket loads of heat shock protein. And that cell, those epithelial barriers were as tight as I've ever seen. They were incredibly resistant. And so at least there was an association between heat shock proteins and gut barrier function.
Right, can I clarify something? So are you saying, I was thinking the reduction in blood flow that occurs with exercise. So just in case people don't know, so, you know, there's a battle during exercise for the blood, as you touched on. So, you know, generally you think, well, digestion isn't a major factor. You're, you know, running away from a tiger or something. Let's just get it done. So you reduce the blood flow to the intestines. But then also you're saying with exercise, you're getting hot. And that's also, you know, a struggle. But you're saying that that's activating heat shock proteins, and that's actually protective, making the gut less leaky?
Well, no. What I'm saying is that if you are, I would argue that a big part of conditioning is is your gut barrier is maintaining. Yeah. So that's why, you know, you see someone like Alberto Salazar, who drove his temperature way up and was still functional. He probably didn't have as much gut leak. And so, you know, you can do this we've done this study, glutamine activates heat shock factor 1. And so we've given glutamine in a number of situations to people and shown that you block gut leak in exercising humans just by pre-medicating them with glutamine.
Right. So just to clarify, so you're saying during exercise, so if you're naive to exercise, for example, when you're exercising, you get a reduction in blood flow, you get hotter, that's going to put a strain on you, you're going to leak more, and the bacteria and things in the gut that are not meant to end up in the blood can end up in the blood and cause...
The endotoxin. I think there probably could be some bacterial translocation, but endotoxin. Now, endotoxin is moving through the portal circulation into the liver. So I wouldn't expect to find endotoxin in the blood if you were to, stick my vein. I would expect that most of that endotoxin is being filtered out by the liver. But of course, giving a dose of endotoxin to the liver creates the same kind of cytokine storm as we've just seen in all the patients with COVID. So it's a cytokine storm that occurs in heat stroke. And that's really a kind of a classic response and the gut really explains a lot of that. It explains the blood pressure instability, the loss of blood flow to the brain, abnormal blood-brain barrier. A lot of that stuff occurs in sepsis or sepsis syndromes. And so I suspect this is just an endotoxin-related illness.
Okay, so just to clarify, so what I had with the City of Surf, that was heat exhaustion. I didn't have heat stroke. But could you just explain what happens there? So I think mine was just a rise in body temperature, and that's like a normal response. But if you keep going, you get a heat stroke. What are you saying is actually happening? How are you getting this endotoxins and things?
Yeah, so when the gut, if the gut barrier is not keeping all the gates closed, then you get leakage of endotoxin molecules. Or fragments of endotoxin or fragments or other things that the immune system has learned to deal with. And so it sounds the alarm. Now, we talk about a continuum, but I don't like the continuum so much because heat stroke is an explosive illness. When gut barrier fails and you get a load of endotoxin, you can crash and burn with heat stroke. And that temperature is different for everybody. Gut health is important. I expect microbiome is important. So the factors that drive when you have this explosive, deadly heat stroke, it's quite variable. And heat, the other thing, we're talking about heat exhaustion, that's largely a temperature effect on, and all the things that direct temperature does, not so much always a gut injury.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I was able to, within hours, I was just back to normal. Yeah. So just to clarify then, so thinking about Chris Lee, and to bring in what you said earlier, so the exercise training, that repeated sort of heat and maybe the stress of the reduction in blood flow increases heat shock proteins in the gut and makes them less likely to be leaky. But in him, I guess he's done a whole Ironman. I wonder if we know what went wrong there. I mean, I guess maybe it could be genetic influences, who knows, but he ended up losing part of his gut. Do you have any idea what happens there? Who knows?
I just think that supports the model that the gut is a vulnerable tissue in exercise and heat illness. We talk about critical target tissues, and I think the gut is really where it's at. So there are a whole bunch of factors of, people who, I would put heat stroke on the continuum with inflammatory bowel diseases like Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, which is, again, a cytokine inflammatory gut issue. Mm-hmm. And you get endotoxin leak. Remember, Crohn's disease, you do see episodes of sepsis and other things as well. So I think heat is just another driver that results in gut injury. And that's a big part of what exertional heat stroke is.
Okay. And that makes sense as well, because obviously exertional heat stroke is going to happen more in untrained people than trained, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right. Now, the other thing, I don't want to forget about the COVID. So I've mentioned a few times to people that I've been lucky enough to go to Copenhagen several times. I'm about to go for 6 months, leaving in a few weeks to work again with Eric Richter. But I saw you've got a Copenhagen link there as well. What's that one? Sure.
That's probably a longer story. I went over. I did a sabbatical with Bitte Klarland in 2007, and we worked on giving glutamine and endotoxin and seeing if we could alter cytokine responses by giving. So she had a model of giving endotoxin to human subjects, and I was giving glutamine to them, And we wanted to see if we could see a difference. We published a paper out of it. I think we didn't see a difference, but I would argue that that was a type 2 error based on the number of people that were in it. But the paper's out there. People can look at it. So while I was there, I was, Ben Saltine and I sort of hung out a bit because I was there for 6 months. And I started talking to Ben about some of his work on looking at arm and leg exercise and how you get steel to the arms. And I posed a question. So he had said that as you get older, and we know this, as you get older, you don't have the same exercise-associated vasodilation in limbs. Mm-hmm. And so then the question was, well, if you don't get that, then is that protective? And maybe these people who do arm and leg exercise who are older might have a different response. Mm-hmm. And he liked the idea. So we organized to do that study. And I went back in 2010 to actually do those studies, and we did them. And then while I was there, I was asked by a group of people. In 2007, I was chair of internal medicine at University of New Mexico. And I was running I was fortunate enough to be running three NIH R01s on various aspects of exercise. One on aging, one on tissue damage, and one on muscle response. And so I had a whole department, there was a faculty member in the department who was a biomedical informaticist who worked half-time in Copenhagen. So while I was in Copenhagen, I said hello, and he said they were having a conference on trying to apply informatics to some clinical to diseases to see if you could figure out if you could develop some kind of predictive models, and would I be willing to give a talk on sepsis? And so I did, and this was out at Danish Technical University Valby, and so it went. People, I talked to him afterwards. We started talking about ideas. And ultimately, I took a 25% position at Danish Technical University. And then the group moved to University of Copenhagen in 2014. So while I was the chair of medicine, University of Copenhagen was paying part of my salary to have me come over and work on these projects.
Busy lab.
I was between the wet lab, the chair job, and working in Denmark. That was pretty exciting.
Wow.
So, I became the dean of medicine at Arkansas. When I left that position, Søren Brunek, who's the director of this center, it's bioinformatics center, asked if I would take a position there. So I did, and I was professor at University of Copenhagen for several years. So.
Wow. So another one I've seen, it's challenging. It's definitely fun over there. I guess you're riding your bike everywhere. I love it over there.
Yeah, it's very nice. So wonderful infrastructure, wonderful people, and it's a great place.
Right, the other thing I saw is you had a review in autophagy on heat shock protein, heat shock responses and autophagy cooperation and control. So proteostasis, et cetera. Did you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So I go back to when I was working with Carl Gisolfi, and when we first started working, I was explaining to him what heat shock proteins were. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, Carl, it's how a cell thinks. So if you go to New York City and you're walking down the street and you feel someone putting a gun in your ribs in the back saying, I want your wallet. Mm-hmm. You're not thinking about where you're going to dinner. You're not thinking about, am I going to a show? You're thinking about how the hell do I get out of this? Mm-hmm. But that's what heat shock proteins are. Mm-hmm. And they are So they are a protein management system. They are they're also a stress tolerance system. But the important thing about them, I think, is that so the heat shock proteins are in everything, from the most basic single cell life forms to the most complex multicellular life forms and everything in between. And so they're a protein management system that is ubiquitous. Autophagy is a protein management system that is largely mammalian. So we ask a very simple question. You've got two overlapping systems. One is ancient, one is new. One, there must be a way that they control each other. And I'm going to argue that the older one controls the newer one. And so we did that study. It was published in Journal of Biological Chemistry. And we showed pretty clearly, if you overexpress heat shock proteins, you don't have autophagy. And when you block heat shock proteins, autophagy occurs even in a resting cell. So even when the cell doesn't need to develop the autophagic response, if there are no heat shock proteins around by silencing, it'll do it.
That's really
interesting. And if you do it, and then the proof of the pudding was, we took humans and we gave them a bunch of glutamine to generate a heat shock response. And then we had them do the exact exercise that was done in this study of exercise and autophagy. And there was no autophagy because there was a heat shock response.
Okay.
So you could actually blunt, even in exercise in humans, the early studies showing that autophagy occurred after exercise, you could blunt that if you prematurely generated heat shock response.
So why don't we just clarify again, what is autophagy, just for people that,
So autophagy is a protein management system in largely mammals that it manages and removes damaged proteins and protein pieces. It's a way of people talk about, saying that they're the cellular garbage collector, or they clean out the cell. So the autophagic response is a process of cleaning damaged or older proteins.
And you're saying they're both essentially doing the same. The heat shock proteins do other things as well.
Yes, heat shock proteins fold. Autophagy isn't really so much involved in refolding. Heat shock proteins are more like that.
They always say chaperone. What's the chaperone? So it's actually the heat shock proteins are sort of chaperoning around the proteins.
So heat shock proteins bind to every peptide at some point, and then you can think of the old ideas that imagine trying to reel a protein off a ribosome, I would think it would curl up like wallpaper, right? So if you're trying to get there's a certain configuration that's necessary. So these heat shock proteins actually bind to proteins coming off the ribosome. They release and folding can occur. They also, though, help assemble multimers. So they are, by these proteins can assemble in groups of several peptides, and they're important in inserting proteins through membranes. So that's why they're the chaperones, right? So we proposed in this one article that what happens in exercise, I'm interested in exercise because exercise is such a phenomenally interesting complex stress. Mm-hmm. And so if you think about exercise, after exercise, you have this autophagic response, presumably to deal with damage that occurs. Now, and that's needed, otherwise things are not going to work. But once that's occurred, if you kept the autophagic response going, you would just go. You would garbage can, everything would go in the garbage and you'd be cleaned out and there'd be nothing. Mm-hmm. So there has to be a way both to shut it off and to, as these new peptides are synthesized from the exercise stress, to build. And so what we said was, okay, so the autophagic response comes on very quickly, and it begins to deal with this stuff. But there's the second curve, which is the heat shock curve, which begins. And as heat shock proteins reach, we would argue that as heat shock proteins reach some level, or controllers reach some level, the paper that we published in JBC says, once you have a bunch of heat shock protein around, the autophagic response stops. And so the little bit slower heat shock response begins to rise, and it stops the autophagic response. Now, as these new peptides are being made, you've got all the chaperones and foldases. And so you've got a wonderful system where heat shock can shut off autophagy. And in that review, we actually did one of the authors is a statistician. So we took every article there was that we could find on animal studies and heat shock responses and animal and human studies and autophagic response. And we synchronized them to the same time zero. And then we watched and saw what happened. And that's what happens. And there's a curve in the paper that shows that you have this really acute rise in the autophagic response. And then staggered a couple hours later, you're seeing the heat shock rise. So it fits the model, and it fits our data from the JBC paper that it is the heat shock response that controls how the autophagic response works.
Okay. And just to clarify for people, we talked about this with Paige Geiger as well, is I guess we haven't talked specifically about muscle and how exercise training increases your heat shock protein. It's mainly 72, yeah, or 70, 72, you know, with exercise training too.
Yeah, so 72 is the most heat responsive, and it's also, you know, we had another paper. I mean, I'm going back to the old papers because I think they're mm-hmm. evidence, I would say. So why the heat shock response? One of the responses in exercise, one thing may simply be that you get an oxidative stress, and so you have all this oxidized glutathione, and that may be a signal to generate a heat shock response, because what the cell is trying to do is defend its reduced glutathione. So it uses a heat shock response as a way to preserve glutathione, reduce glutathione. So yeah, you get a pretty robust heat shock response in exercising muscle, especially with eccentric contraction.
Yeah, so you get the acute increase, but then the training also increases expression, is that right?
Right, that's right. That's right.
Right. Now, another one I saw just looking through your bits and pieces, I actually saw a tweet someone had sent that the heat and health keynote speaker, Pope Mosley, emphasizes that heat-related illnesses represent a small fraction of disease driven by heat. Just wondering what that actually means.
Yeah, so we're going to jump forward a little bit, and this involves a lot of the Danish stuff. So. Mm-hmm. I'm going to park the thermoregulation, heat shock, exercise stuff right here. It's important for this, but it's going to come later. So when I was in Denmark, as I began working on this with these colleagues at Danish Technical University, Søren Brunek is the big kahuna there. We were trying to sort out, could the path you've walked, could the diagnoses you accumulate over your lifetime, could that be useful and predictive of what happens? Because when you look at a lot of clinical trials, you know, we don't do a very good job of really understanding a person's the disease path they've walked. Mm-hmm. And so that information really suggested that there's a lot of interaction between, no surprise, there's a lot of interaction between diseases. So you can have two people, let's take two 55-year-olds. Mm-hmm. One of them had a motorcycle crash at 18, had an amputation, had a little bit of renal failure after the crash, and then at age 50 develops diabetes. Okay. The other 50-year-old got diabetes when he was 18, had really bad complications, had an amputation, had renal failure. They're both 50. They both have the same diagnoses, but those are two very, very different people. One of them has really important vascular disease. The other one just had an accident. And so, so that's what we had been doing in Denmark. So in going and working with colleagues in Arizona, the other thing that I brought was my clinical skills. And I can tell you, as an intensive care doctor, every time you have a heat wave, the hospital fills up. But it doesn't fill up with heat stroke. It fills up with people having heart attacks, and their dementia is out of control. They have renal failure. They have their heart failure gets bad. Their asthma gets bad. And so when you really look at what happens with heat, only about 10% of what you call heat-related illness, or only on heat-related illness, only 10% of the picture. So last year in Phoenix, we had about 500 heat-related deaths. But I tell my colleagues, no, we had probably 5,000 or 6,000. We just didn't see it. We didn't understand it. And these these diagnoses that people have help us define the phenotype of the heat vulnerable. So a paper we did, I think it's in Nature Communications, where we took every Dane who had a diagnosis of sepsis, about 120,000 over 20 years. And then we stopped at 30 days before the hospital admission for sepsis, so none of the acute diagnoses got involved. And we just looked at everybody's path. What were your diagnoses?
That's a big job. No,
some hours of computer time. I mean, it's informatics, right? So we did not have information about what happened to them in the hospital. We didn't know if they were ventilated. We didn't know if they got antibiotics. We didn't know if their blood pressure was low. All we knew is that they were admitted with a diagnosis of sepsis. And we could predict pretty accurately who was going to live or die, not based upon what happened in that hospitalization, but what their life history of diagnoses were. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's highly predictive. So I would argue that that same strategy may help us identify the most heat vulnerable, that 90% that we're missing. And by doing that, we can start preparing and developing better strategies to, yes, we want to make sure the 500 people who died, could we decrease that number? But that 5,000 people that died, we need to do something about that. That is an incredible problem, that only 10% of what we see as heat-related illness is actually what's happening. And in a place like Phoenix that's had a maximum temperature of 50 degrees Celsius, I mean, that's hot. So it's a big job, but I think it's something that's really exciting. And that's what I mean by the
idea. That's really interesting and important. And I had no idea that was the case. I was just wonder if that's part of the reason, you know, we know that exercise is so good for us. And, you know, as you get older, it's even more maybe important to exercise. Wonder if exercise can, by activating heat shock proteins and various other things we probably don't even know about, wonder if exercise is allowing us to overcome some of this. So the guy that crashed his motorbike and damaged his spleen or something like that, you said, can exercise then kind of ameliorate some of that earlier?
I think it is. I think when you look at these diagnoses, you see people's diagnoses. We unfortunately do not have any kind of ICD-10 marker, you know, the classification of diseases for exercise. I wish we did, because I suspect that the people who are exercising are generally doing better. I mean, this is I tell people why, you know, there are a lot of reasons people exercise. For me, it's being able to carry my groceries up a flight of stairs when I'm 80.
Yeah. So I wonder if you went back, that bioinformatics, I wonder if you look back at those people, the 4,500 or 4,000, whatever you said, that died, that wasn't directly due to the heat, you can think. Wonder if they're less fit, you know what I mean? Wonder if there's a bit of a relationship there as well.
Yes, absolutely. I think, so if you look, there's a really nice study of 9 European cities that had a big heat wave. And they looked at the mortality, who died, okay? And they did get a much clearer picture, because all they were doing is saying, here's the time point of the heat wave, who died? Mm-hmm. So they didn't look for heat-related death, yes, they just looked for death. Mm-hmm. And the most common diagnosis, the thing that was increased, 90% increase, respiratory disease, mm-hmm. not heart disease. But when you look at we had this paper 2014 in Nature Communications, where we took the entire population of Denmark and we developed these disease networks. When you look at the network that included chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, you can see that network is a network of people with lots and lots of diagnoses. So I would argue, I don't have the information, but I would argue that the take-home message from that paper, the heat wave paper, is that the reason people with lung disease died is not because it was a lung issue, but because it was a marker of frailty. It was a marker of people with lots and lots of diseases. Mm-hmm. So if you had lung disease and then you came into the hospital and you died, you probably had a whole bunch of other diseases as well, other diagnoses. So you were in a sort of, we would say, if you were a cancer patient, we'd say you were or had a poor performance status.
Back to the level of fitness. That's interesting you're saying about Denmark, because you know, as we touched on, everyone rides their bikes, like literally, you know, almost everyone. They ride their bike to go out for the evening. They'll have women with high heels on and a bottle of champagne and the basket in the front. It's just fantastic.
Yes,
we do. I always said, oh, these Danes are so fit. And they'd point out to me sometimes, no, it's the city. So in Copenhagen, everyone rides their bike, but in the rural centers, people aren't as healthy and fit. So I wonder if you looked at the Denmark data and looked at the cities versus the country. I mean, there's I'm sure there's all sorts of covariance there, like wealth is going to be higher in Copenhagen. But
Oh, it is. But you know, the nice thing about Denmark is that I think their success is the fact that everything is, there's nothing too low and nothing too high. Mm-hmm. So if you go into a burger restaurant, the price of a burger is pretty high compared to, say, the States. But if you go to the world's best restaurant, Noma,
yes,
you can have an incredible meal. And it's expensive, but it's 20% of the price of what you would pay for a similar highly touted restaurant in the United States.
Is that right? Because we actually did go to Noma. It was ranked number one or two in the world at that stage. And we thought that was incredibly expensive, but I guess we haven't tried to go to the most expensive restaurants in America.
Well, I mean, Noma's expensive, but you know, you can drop I won't mention names of restaurants, but, and I don't, you know, I'm not someone who goes to a lot of these, but you can be hit for $1,000+ in a similar Michelin star restaurant. You're not going to get hit like that in Denmark. And you know, the Danish model, when you look at healthcare outcomes, there's one statistic that holds up. If you take the ratio of the lowest paid worker from the highest paid worker, whatever that ratio is, the lower that ratio, the better the health outcomes of the country. The higher that ratio, the worse the health outcomes. Mm-hmm. So the Danes have really been good about keeping everything towards the middle. And
free education, free, even universities, they not only is the university free, but they students are actually getting paid to go, even undergrad students. So I think the so-called socialized medicine is a bad thing. I don't want to get too political here, but and the amazing thing, just to finish up very quickly with that, is you talk to the people, go, oh, but the Danes pay such high tax. And I've asked a few of them, would you like to have a tax cut? And they're like, no, because then you wouldn't have as much welfare, and then you wouldn't have as much, you know, good health care and the universities. They were like horrified. No, we don't want to have a tax cut. It's a totally different, you know.
Yeah, and remember this, the U.S. is the land of the hidden tax. So you have state tax, federal tax, Social Security, Medicare, boom, 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 boom. And you don't get the same bang for the buck on infrastructure. So, I mean, it's not straightforward. But my point originally was that the Danes are about as tight in terms of closely aligned in terms of healthcare access, that you do, people may have different habits, but you certainly have great healthcare access. So issues of access, which become really important in doing studies in the States, those are much less important in Denmark.
All right, great. So, okay, so how did you end up? Now, I have to say that the reason I actually thought to have you on was a person that follows the podcast on Twitter sent me something about kettlebell exercise, how he'd be, because I've got a dodgy back. I've got torn discs in my back. And he said, oh, you should be doing the kettlebell. And I said, I can't think of anything worse. I feel like picking it up, it just hurt my back, you know. And anyway, he sent me an article, and I was like, Pope Mosley. I just thought, how many people are called Pope Mosley? And it turned out it was you writing this article about kettlebell exercise. So why don't you tell us about how that's become a thing, and you're now an instructor, and
Well, sure. People joke, my exercise program is work hard, hard, harder, hurt, recover, hard, hard, harder, break something else, recover. As you know, I went from running, I was running 400 meters in the days with Carl.
Tell us some times here that you and Carl were running.
Oh yeah, Carl in college was a sub 49 indoor runner for Manhattan College.
400 meters.
And he trained me up. He got me up to running probably, we could do a hand-timed 57, 400 meters when I was 40. We'd run interval. Carl and I used to run these endless relays where we'd get a baton and one of us would hand off to each other and see how 5 or 10 miles. So, I mean, you're trying to hold those 400 meter times in the sort of high 60s. And that doesn't, if you're really, those people who are listening who are really trained up, that doesn't seem like much. But on that 20th one, that is really a bear. So I get hurt, and I swam for a while and did stuff. And I became the dean at Arkansas, and it became really hard to get a workout going because dean jobs are, they say the stuff comes at you like a fire hose. And a dean in America, so you not only managing the education, the medical school and all, and the research enterprise, but you are managing a large clinical operation. So you're managing a huge multi-specialty practice, 1,200 plus physicians. So there's a lot of stuff going on, and it's going fast. And so I didn't get it. I couldn't get out to do much work. So I tried to do, I tried my hand at CrossFit and jumping on boxes and stuff. And in doing so, I had an acute L5 S1 herniation. And so it was worst pain of my life. It was terrible. I mean, if you have back pain, you know. I had to have emergency surgery. They did a microdiscectomy and left the nucleus so I could have a chance at having the disc grow back and all. Fortunately, I woke up, I had no pain, but I had like 12 weeks where I was sort of sitting around doing some walking and some easy bicycling, trying to figure out how I was going to get back in shape. And in my rehab, I started reading because I'm a fellow of the American College of Sports Medicine. I started reading, And I started looking at this stuff on kettlebells. And then when I went to rehab, I realized that I was swimming, you know, 10,000 yards a week. And I had great linear strength, but I was kind of noodly the other way. So I found someone who could teach me how to do a kettlebell swing. He was a strong first certified instructor. And he taught me, and I really liked it. And I got stronger and healthier. And so then I went on and I did the strong first SFG1 certification when I was 64. And it's a tough certification. I mean, you know, you have to do 100 snatches with a 20 or 24 kilo kettlebell in 5 minutes. That's a lot of work. And then I went on when I was 67 and got my SFG2 certification. And I think it's a great way to do things. And I'll say, you know, the guy who's sort of responsible for a lot of this kettlebell popularization is Pavel Satsulin. And I've had the pleasure of getting to know Pavel. He's one of the smartest exercise physiologists I know. I've sent him articles and he'll give me critiques better than many of my colleagues. He's really, really a bright guy. And he knows a lot. And it's fun to talk to him because the talk we're having today is kind of similar to the way he and I would talk. Okay. So I do it. I like it. He's a smart guy.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about Pavel? Because I have a bit of a dilemma here with this podcast. My whole brief is to interview the who's who of exercise, you know, physiology, metabolism, and exercise and health. They got to have a good H index, which you do. You know, they've got to have done really well and been a leader in their research. So I think, it'd be awesome to have someone like Pavel, but he hasn't got, you know what I mean? It doesn't fit the brief. And I think it'd be awesome to try and get, you know, Eliud Kipchoge on or something, but it doesn't fit the brief. A lot of other people are interviewing all these people. But so I need to try and keep in my brief because, you know, there's so many podcasts out there. And, you know, I know Pavel has been on all sorts of Joe Rogan and whatever. So can you fill me in on Pavel? Because I'm not going to interview him. It doesn't fit the brief, but he's obviously a very interesting chap.
Well, I mean, I think he's my knowledge of him is related to kettlebells, and he really understands. First of all, he understands the biomechanics, the fact that the reason kettlebells are good for your back is because you're actually, if you were to swing a kettlebell in front of you and try to drive it with your arms, you're putting tremendous force on your back. You don't want that.
Which is so what I look at. I look at it and go, oh, that hurts just looking at it.
So the image is, you've seen sometimes in when they're knocking a building down, they have a wrecking ball, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So the ball's a kettlebell. Your core is the machine. Your arms are the chain. The chain does not impart anything. The chain is merely the connection. And it has to be a tight connection, no slack. So kettlebells are about mindfulness, mindful practice. It's about keeping the slack out and tightening what you need to tighten. And it's about generating force from your core. The other thing Pavel understands is what interval training was all about. So you remember when the Swedes really popularized interval training, and then Fox and at Indiana brought a lot of that work forward. What the Swedes were trying to do, and I think you can correct me, but I think I'm correct on this. So the idea was, how could you build your heart? You know, you could do this long distance stuff and try to just build it. Or what you could do is you know, when you drive your heart rate very high, when you're up towards a max heart rate, you're not doing that really with much stroke volume change. You're doing it all with rate, right? So it's increasing cardiac. So when you're running at max, that's a rate issue. Now, stroke volume is what you need to generate hypertrophy in the muscle. Running at a high rate doesn't really do that. When you run it at a high rate, you don't really build much of a stroke volume because all your heart's doing is just kind of twitching and moving bits of blood. When you suddenly stop, though, that intense interval, you get these huge loads of blood that are coming back from the fact that you've been moving all this blood through you. So you get this tremendous stretch, and that's the build they wanted. So that's why when they talked about intervals, they talked about 3-to-1, 5-to-1 rest ratios. Because in fact, the only reason you're doing the exercise is to set yourself up. It's like you're riding a ski lift up. That's the interval. It's the ride down on the ski, that's the recovery. And the only way you build, the only way the magic happens is if you can actually use that rest interval to build. Pavel understands that very well. I see people talking about negative intervals all the time. It's like, in my opinion, it's like saving the peel and throwing away the banana. The banana is during the rest when you can adapt. Just driving your heart high or working a muscle to failure, that I don't see that as really helpful. I think, you know, there are times you have to do that. If you're training for the 400, you do have to do some all-out sprints, but there's a lot of rest. You see those guys, when you see people doing those 50-meter sprints, they take a lot of rest afterwards, minutes and minutes. And when you run the first 350 meters, what you're trying to do actually is be able to run as fast as possible with as little effort as possible. So that's where the intervals, the recovery interval is so important. So I'm a big, I've always thought this. I listened to Pavel talk about it, and he presents data very well about this. You go to one of his courses, they're full of data.
Well, that's interesting. I have not, can I step back a little bit? So my understanding of stroke volume is so if you're talking about running, yeah? So when you're starting off at the, so your stroke volume in a normal person is like 70 mils, yeah? 70 mils per beat, 70 beats per minute. So you're pumping out about 5 liters, 70 times 70, 4,900 mils. My understanding was as you increase the intensity, your stroke volume goes up and your heart rate goes up. And then the stroke volume plateaus out. And that might be what you're saying is the stroke volume plateaus out at about maybe 50% VO2 max or so.
Yes.
And then after that, it's the increase in heart rate. The stroke volume stays the same. The increase in heart rate is how you get that bigger and bigger cardiac output, yeah? And that's what you say. It's not like your stroke, I just want to make sure people are clear. It's not like your stroke volume is not doing anything. It's going right. It's plateauing out. And then the main part above that. So maybe you're saying if you're doing like long, slow distance sort of thing, you're getting that sort of same sort of stroke volume probably. But then the heart rate is what's pumping it up when you're doing the intensity, yeah? And is that,
and
is
so,
that
just making sure when you, clean? Yeah. Yes. And so when you stop, the interval,
yeah,
and your heart rate begins to come down, you're still, there's still all this cardiac output moving. And so what you see, of course, is you see stroke volume going up. As that heart rate comes down during that first part of that interval, stroke volume again picks up as your heart rate comes back down. And it's that stretch that seems to be important in building.
I didn't know that. So you'll say the cardiac stroke adaptation volume is actually, so during the recovery, it's not like the stroke volume and heart rate are both dropping. The stroke volume is actually staying up relative to the heart rate.
Yeah.
During the recovery.
Yeah.
I did not know that. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Wow. All right. This has been a great chat. Is there anything else? Let's see. Three pillars. Actually, what about just some of your other, I guess it's all around the same thing. A tweet from Strong First. Three pillars for healthy aging. Grip, posture, and ability to get up from the floor.
Yeah.
Is that all going to be help from kettlebell, or is that supplementary stuff you'd be doing as well?
You can do it with kettlebells. I mean, I think so. In talking to Pavel, I write on Instagram about exercise and aging, and so Pavel suggested I take some of these thoughts and put it together. So I wrote, I said, what are the, when you look at sort of a minimalist approach to what's important for healthy aging. So what are the markers that show when something declines, that's you're becoming more frail. One is clearly grip strength. So as your grip strength declines, you become more frail. The second is getting off the floor, because there's some really nice studies that people who have trouble getting off the floor that's a bad marker. And then the third, there's a lot of talk about gait speed. How fast can an older person walk? But in the studies that control for posture, I don't know that gait speed is an independent, is important and independent as much as posture. That the reason you have the gait speed is because you can control your structure, that you've got a solid structure, and therefore your gait speed's okay. So I, in each of these, I said, well, here are the things that kettlebells do for you that I think you can actually do you can build a program around that. So for grip strength, there are any number of kettlebell modalities that strengthen grip. For getting up off the floor, the Turkish get up, which I think is a wonderful exercise. And then for posture, it's the bent press and the windmill. So the bent press, also called the spiral press, I think is, along with the deadlift, the most important thing you can do. It loosens up your thoracic spine. It gives you power. I mean, you know, the world record one arm press, how much can one person take one arm and just press it straight up? It's in the sort of, 150 pound range. I'd have to look up the number, but the bent press, again, a one arm press, people putting up over 300 pounds.
So how does that look?
So the bent press, you set your arm against your lat, you tighten your lat, you rotate the upper part of your torso, and then you hinge down while holding. So as you hinge down, you contract your lat. And so like an Olympic weightlifter, you are maneuvering under the weight. So you tighten your lat, you're doing a forward press, but your shoulders are turned 90 degrees to your hips. And then your arm extends up. And then once the weight's over your head, you stand up. I think it's, people might want to look at that. I'm not ready to demonstrate it right now, but
what is your Instagram? I actually had a look at your Instagram and straight away I went, okay, my back felt better straight away, because the couple of things I saw, I only watched a couple. I thought, okay, I could see this could be good, because it wasn't like heaving the weights around. You know what I mean? It was very controlled, slow.
Yeah.
I thought I could probably do that.
Yes. Yeah. Removing the slack and using your core strength is really what's important. The other thing for grip strength, I think, is pull-ups are great. One of the things that I also point out in there is that the amount of work you need to do to maintain some level of fitness is quite small. I have argued that if you, again, from the Strong First people, if you were to take a kettlebell, learn how to do a swing, take a kettlebell to your office, and every hour do for four consecutive minutes on every hour, do 3 to 5 kettlebell swings. Do them perfectly, do them forcefully, but do 3 to 5. So you're talking about 12 to 20 swings, and do them throughout the day. So every 56 minutes, you take the last 4 minutes of the hour, the three swings will take you 5 to 10 seconds. So you do 5 seconds of work, and then every minute for 4 minutes, that's it. And when you look at people who do that kind of exercise, it has a remarkable impact on insulin sensitivity, a number of markers. It doesn't take much. And so people who are stressed about getting on a treadmill for 40 minutes in the gym, I'd try something like this first. People I've recommended this to, they've seen really good positive things.
Right. All right. So what I like to ask people towards the end is, what are you excited about at the moment? Maybe that's what you're excited about. What are you working on that you're excited about at the moment?
Yeah, I'm the heat and health thing is pretty neat. I think we have an opportunity. Phoenix is the most important climate lab in the country for heat. It's going through an urbanization. It's highly urbanized, but the urbanization has driven the high lows, you know, the low temperatures of each day has driven them up, which is what happens in urbanization. And that's associated with worse heat waves. So I think Phoenix I tell the faculty, unless you're in a completely isolated laboratory working on cells, you are working on heat. It doesn't matter if you're working on school lunches or, anything. If you're working on health in any way, you are working on heat if you're in Phoenix. So trying to build this program has been really satisfying, and I like it a lot. The other thing is I'm doing this, a really neat thing that Strong First does called the Tactical Strength Challenge. It is, they do it once a year, three events. Number one, how much can you deadlift? One shot, you get three attempts, what's your best deadlift? Number two, how many pull-ups can you do? And they're, you know, full pull-ups, chin touching over the bar, all the way down to the bottom. And then how many snatches with your test weight kettlebell can you do in 5 minutes? So the snatch, you know, there's data on how many calories a minute you burn. That's a highly aerobic event. So you have the strength aerobic component. With the deadlift, the bigger you are, the better you do. But with pull-ups, the lighter you are, the better you do. So it's how do you find the place for you that maximizes all three? I think it's a brilliant way of doing things. And so I'm starting to train up for that. So
there you go. So Strong First. Now I pride myself on this podcast. I have no affiliates, no advertising, I get not 1 cent through anything. But so I don't want to be seen to be like plugging something, it's an advertisement or something. But what is Strong First? Is that an accrediting body? Is it
it's Pavel's accrediting, but you know, Pavel started Strong First. It's the organization, it's one of the organizations that does kettlebells. I don't get any pay from them. I'm certified by them. I don't have it. So I have no disclosures, no nothing. I have found it to be really useful. There are other kettlebell organizations. There are other good exercise organizations. I just happen to have found this one when I was recovering from back surgery, and it's been a very positive thing.
So I wasn't implying that you were advertising. It's more that I didn't want advertising by asking the question. Well, hey, thank you.
That's fine.
Actually, I was going to say thank you and see you later. But what I like to do is just a few sort of takeaway messages at the end. So what would you... takeaway messages you'd like people to get from this chat? It's quite wide ranging, but
heat shock proteins are how cells think, and we haven't talked about the whole role of heat shock proteins in viral replication, which
want to do that?
Briefly, I mean, I think the thing that we figured out, every viral infection has a heat shock protein burst associated with it, and it occurs very early in the viral infection. And so it had been thought that this was the cell's response to a stress. Virus comes in, new proteins, that the cell is responding to all these proteins and it's under stress. That was the wisdom. My friend, and a brilliant scientist, Matt Cotton, and I were sitting in my kitchen in Iowa City having a beer talking about this. And I remember saying, you know, Matt, if I were a virus and I had this limited genome, I would take over the heat shock system. I would, because I need it to assemble. So I would do like in the, in all those military tactical things, take over the airport, land the troops. That's taking over the heat shock system. So Matt, using a system that he had, actually engineered a way to show, to do the experiment. And that is the case. So that paper we did in Nature in 99, where we showed that the heat shock response is the virus's way to get done what it needs to get done. It's not the cell's way of protecting itself.
Wow.
And so it's kind of a shift. That is probably why heat shock protein peptide complexes are strongly immunogenic. They're strong drivers of our immune response. There's been a lot of interest in using heat shock protein peptide complexes for cancer therapy, you know, taking the peptides of a tumor and tying it to a heat shock protein and then seeing if you can generate more of an immune response. So we have some patents on that. But
so if you take a heat shock protein 72 knockout or various heat shock protein knockout and expose it to a virus, they struggle worse, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know if that's the case, but I know that if you take a virus, you know, the adenovirus we used with Matt, we did another paper where a colleague was working on papillomavirus, and we used one of our gene transfer vectors to overexpress heat shock protein in her system, and we got a tenfold increase in viral production. So I don't know about shutting off the heat shock response has its own consequences, and of course, since it's such an important immune, it's such an important danger signal, shutting it off may impair the immune response. That's true. Clearly, I'd say viruses are great at evolving away from things that are a problem for them. The heat shock proteins are a problem in a sense because they generate an immune response, but viruses haven't evolved away from it. So it's probably really important.
Actually, I think my question might have been a bit silly now. Okay, so yeah, just to finish up the takeaways then. So your takeaways are?
Yeah, heat shock proteins are how cells think. Only 10% of the deaths and morbidity from heat are classified as heat-related illness. Mm-hmm. And build strength because you want to be able to carry a bag of groceries up a flight of stairs when you're 85.
Exactly right. Fantastic. All right. Well, thank you for coming on. It's been great. And
pleasure, Glenn.
Okay. See you next time. Bye-bye. Might see you in Copenhagen. Who knows? Okay.
See
you.
Maybe.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Please like, subscribe, pass it on to your friends and colleagues. Check out the other podcasts. Thanks again.